You are tuned to CILU 102.7 FM. Here's what's up in Thunder Bay for Tuesday, March 3rd. Trix Lounge presents Tokes on You. It's 19 plus. It's $5 and it features Trevor Green and Cross Kid, and it starts at 7:30. Cheers, the Village Pub has open mic night featuring Chris Tonkins. All ages, no cover, goes from 8 until 11. And the Foundry presents the best karaoke show in Thunder Bay. It's 19 plus. There's no cover, and that will start at 10. And if we look into the future, we will see that you can head on Wednesday to Cambrian Bears Studio at 818 Spray Street to see Four Weddings and an Elvis. It's all ages, $20 to $25, and it will start at 7:30.
For more details and a complete listing of what's happening in our city, go to tvshows.com. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned to CILU 102.7 FM.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Thunder Bay. And welcome to this week's episode of It's Pretty Trivial with me, Joshua. And I'd like to welcome you all here today. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at TrivialIt, capital T for Trivial, capital I for It, at TrivialIt on Twitter. No spaces, all one word. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. And I'd just like to welcome you all here. I'm going to try and start something new today where I do a little bit of a weather forecast, what the weather's like out there. So just a fair warning for anyone that's driving today. The roads are a little slippery, a little dangerous out there, so be wary. We got snow out there right now, and according to Environment Canada, it's -1. So careful when you leave this morning. I heard flurries today. And I think I read about 2 centimeters. Yeah, about 2 centimeters. So just be careful when you leave the house today. Stay safe. If you've got nowhere to go, I hope you stay tuned to the program today. Today's episode is going to be all about paradoxes. And kind of paradoxes in math, physics, and philosophy. We're going to try and start with the origin of paradoxes. And what better way to start but with the word paradox itself? In the 1530s, the word paradox started being used. It was derived from the Latin paradoxum and the Greek paradoxon. What does the 1530s word mean? The word is said to mean a statement contrary to common belief or expectation. Even though this word in English is not that old, the concept goes back to a much earlier time. It goes back to the Greeks, in fact. The Greek philosopher Zeno, who is said to have made one of the first and most famous paradoxes. Zeno of Elea lived from 490 to 430 BCE. His most famous paradox is Achilles and the tortoise. What is this paradox, and how can it be solved? It's a pretty interesting one. It's a very famous one, and I'm sure some of you might have heard of it, actually. I'm going to give you a second to think. So, what it is it's Achilles and the tortoise is a paradox in which, where is it here? It's about how Achilles is a fast runner. So there's a race, and the quickest runner can never overtake the slowest, since the pursuer must first reach the point whence the pursuit started. So the slower must always hold the lead. So for the first to hold the lead, in the paradox of Achilles and the tortoise, Achilles is in a foot race with the tortoise. Achilles allows the tortoise a head start of 100 meters, for example. Suppose that each racer starts running with some constant speed, one faster than the other. After some finite time, Achilles will have run 100 meters, bringing him to the tortoise's starting point. During the time, the tortoise has run a much slower distance, say 2 meters. It will then take Achilles some further time to to run that distance, by which time the tortoise will have advanced further, and then more time still to reach the third point while the tortoise moves ahead. Thus, whenever Achilles arrives somewhere the tortoise has been, he still has some distance to go before he can even reach the tortoise. As Aristotle noticed, this argument is similar to the dichotomy. So basically what it is it's saying Zeno will get to the tortoise. We'll get to the tortoise's starting point, but the tortoise is gone a bit more. So then he runs next to that tortoise's starting point, but the tortoise has moved a little bit more. And it keeps going and going and going. And you get it to basically the distance becomes basically infinite. And it becomes a really interesting paradox. Now there is a solution to this paradox. What is it? So, the way to look at this is it goes to the root of the problem of continuum. Aristotle is said to have been one of the few people, I believe it was one of the last people to be able to read Zeno's paradoxes in its entirety, because Zeno had more than one paradox. However, the Achilles and the tortoise is one of his most famous. Aristotle's solution was to involve treating the segments of Achilles' motion as only potential and not actual, since he never actualizes them by stopping. And in anticipation of modern measure theory, Aristotle argued that an infinity of subdivisions of a distance that is finite does not preclude the possibility of traversing that distance, since the subdivisions do not have actual existence unless something is done to them. In this case, stopping at them. So because Zeno never stops at them, he can still make it to the end. Because even though it seems like it's becoming an infinitely small distance he travels, the tortoise will eventually reach the end of the race. And even though Zeno is going smaller, Achilles is going smaller and smaller paces, he will still eventually reach that point because he won't pass the tortoise. The tortoise will still be in front of him. He'll finish the race last. And it's a really interesting paradox, and it's one of the more well-known ones. And actually, one of the ones I thought of when I was doing this episode, I thought, why not do Zeno's paradox? So that's the Zeno's paradox. Now, Zeno has other famous ones. However, it's said that only two really survive to the modern day. But Achilles and the tortoise is his most famous. I believe his other one is the dichotomy, but we will look at that later. The next one is the bootstrap paradox. Now, this is one I'm sure a lot of sci-fi fans have heard of, and if they haven't heard of, they've probably heard of it without hearing of it. So what is the bootstrap paradox? I'll give you a second to think. So anyone that's a fan of, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars, or not necessarily Star Wars, but even I think you might even be able to look Doctor Who. I think even in Avengers, they kind of looked at it. But this is a really interesting one. What the bootstrap paradox is it's kind of like a causal loop. What happens is, for example, one of the most famous examples is, imagine you're a time traveler and you buy a copy of Hamlet from the bookstore. And then you travel back in time to Elizabethan London and hand the book to Shakespeare, who then copies it out and claims it as his own work. Over the centuries that follow, Hamlet is reprinted and reproduced countless times until finally a copy of it ends up back in the same original bookstore where the time traveler finds it and buys it and takes it back to Shakespeare. Who then wrote the book Hamlet? Now, I'm sure a lot of people have actually heard of this one. And if not, I'm sure some of your famous stories or famous movies that you've watched have had it. I believe Avengers Endgame kind of had the causal loop in it. And it's a really interesting example of doesn't really make sense. And it's really weird to just think that that can work. And it's there's a lot of kind of themes that follow this. And the causal loop is a weird one. I don't know if there's a solution or not, actually. I can't find really many that have a great explanation because it's... I don't think there really is one. How do you explain a paradox that... Who did write the book? How did it become a creation? So, for me, I find one of the fun ones. Now, there's another famous paradox we're going to look at in a second. But first, I think I'm going to put on a song. Now, the songs today I kind of picked because they have some kind of paradoxical statement. Not necessarily like a paradox, but more of like a more of like a language paradox. Now, the first one I'm going to put on is probably one people have heard before. It's a good one. I think it is. And I'm sure people will know it when I put it on. It's by a female artist. And she's pretty well known. Who's the artist and what's the song? Now, I'll give you a few options. It's A, Hot and Cold by Katy Perry. B, California Girls by Katy Perry. Or C, it is Bad Romance by Lady Gaga. Which one is it? A, B, or C? Give you a second to think. You'd be right if you said A. Katy Perry's Hot and Cold. In the song, it goes... Where is it here? It goes, you're hot when you're cold. You're yes, then you're no. You're wrong, then you're right. That's kind of paradoxical statements. They contradict each other. So these contradicting statements make it a paradoxical English song. So here is Katy Perry Hot and Cold on CILU 102.7 FM.
Yeah. like a girl changes clothes. Cause you're hot.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. And that was Katy Perry, Hot and Cold, our first paradoxical song of the day. Now, I was just looking up a little bit more on the bootstrap paradox, and as far as I can find, because some of these paradoxes, I've tried to read as much as I can on them beforehand, but sometimes I miss a few things. Quickly back to the bootstrap paradox. The answer is it was written by someone, just we don't know who wrote it. Think of it like you're on a pillar in the clouds, and the clouds cover the pillar, and the pillar's so tall you can't see the ground, and clouds cover it. Does it exist? Does the ground exist? Is there a ground? Is it an infinitely high pillar? We don't know. All we know for sure is that we are on a pillar that we don't know the height of. But we do know there's got to be something under those clouds. And that's how the bootstrap paradox works. Now, the next paradox is a really interesting one. It involves probabilities and will not be the first one today. We actually have two probability ones, which are both a very interesting one to look at. And for those of you who haven't heard of either of them, I'm sure if I explain them to you, you'll have heard at least one of them. This one is a little more less known, I think. But either way, it's still a really interesting concept. It's hard to wrap your head around. For people who know probability, I'm sure all of you will know exactly the answer to this one, or maybe it will still screw you up. Now, this defies common sense. That's all I'm going to say. What it says is we assume that the probability of a random child being a boy is exactly the same as being a girl, which isn't completely true. There are slightly more boys than girls, but if you take into account, would only complicate the problem numerically and would not change the logic in any way. So even though it's not exactly 50-50, just say it's 50-50. Now, let's say someone tells a certain person, let's call him Peter, has two children, but we're not told anything about them apart from one of the following pieces of information. Peter has a son, that is, at least one of Peter's children is a boy, and Peter has a son born on a Tuesday, that is, at least one of Peter's children is a boy born on Tuesday. Now, we can ask the following question for case A and case B separately. What is the probability that Peter has a daughter? Well, I think all of us will say 50% in both cases. Counterintuitive as it may seem, if we assume the interpretation below, neither of the answers is 50%, and the answers are not the same. So, this is where it gets weird. Because this is where it gets interesting. So the case A, son born on any day of the week. Let's deal with the scenario A first because it's the easiest one. We know Peter has at least one son. So there are three different possibilities. Both children are boys. The older child is a boy and the younger is a girl. The older child is a girl and the younger is a boy. Symbolically, Peter's children could have been born in any of the following orders. boy, 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 girl, girl, boy. And the order girl, girl is not possible because Peter has at least one boy. So all three variants have the same probability and cover 100% of possible cases. So each probability is 1/3, or around 33% chance. There is a girl in two of the three cases. So the probability that Peter has a daughter is 66.7%. Now, anyone familiar with it could, you know, look at it through, what's it called? It's Bayes' theorem, I believe. It's the whole conditional probability, but we're just going to skip over that because it's a little more complicated. Now, another way to look at this is look at the whole population of people with two children. There's four groups. Peter has a son. Peter does not belong to the girl-girl group, blah, blah, blah. There's four possibilities then. But a randomly selected person from this population would have a daughter 2/3 of the time. Now, in the real world, it wouldn't be exactly 2/3 since four groups would not have exactly the same size, but it's close enough. And that's where it gets kind of weird, because the other probability is also semi-similar, where you get 14 out of 27% of the time, he would have, I believe, another son. So this is where it's counterintuitive. So like the previous case, we write down all the possibilities. Days of the week, numbers 1 to 7, with 1 being Monday, 2 Tuesday, and so on. Now we denote the event, a boy was born on day N as BN. Similarly for girl, GN. For example, B3 means a boy born on a Wednesday, G1 means a girl born on a Monday. Using the notation, we can write down events like B3, G1, and then so on and so forth. Now let's assume that it is equally likely for a child to be born on any day of the week, which, just like the child's sex, is not completely true, but it's a reasonable assumption to make for an easy problem. This leads to the following 27 equally likely probabilities, probably equally likely ways Peter's children could have been born, each of them containing B2, representing a boy born on Tuesday. But wait a minute. There is no B2 in the last column because we already covered that in the third column. So if you write out all the probabilities, you'd get two boy two, because there's two probable ways that both boys are born on a Tuesday in both columns, boy one, then boy two, or boy two, then boy one. So this means there's 27 probabilities, out of which 14 include a girl. The probability Peter has a daughter is 51.9%. But since we learned from the first part that Peter, the likelihood of a girl is 66.7%, but now if you include B, it completely changes the answer. How is that possible? Why does that work? Now, the reason it works is that the information we got tells us Peter is a random member of a certain special group of people with two children who have a son. Now, this is where it kind of becomes weird. Now, if the other child, if he just had a random other child, it would be 50-50 because you don't specify boy or girl. So say we ask the probability that the other child's a girl, of course, 50%. But the thing is the other child is where it becomes an issue. Now, it also can come into effect the whole Bayes' theorem and the probabilities of, you know, a girl, a boy, not a girl. And the thing is there's some weird probability that actually creates the whole problem itself. Because you add that specific, Peter has a son, doesn't have a son, Peter has a daughter, doesn't have a daughter, that actually changes the probability. And it's kind of a weird thing to interpret, but I have an easier example of this as one of our later examples that I'm hoping to look at after the break. I know this is long and kind of complicated, but in mathematics, there's some really weird probabilities. And the next one we're going to look at after the break is very similar to the last one. However, it's a very famous paradox that I guarantee you almost every single person's heard of. And look up any video on YouTube, and the next paradox we're going to look at will be all over YouTube. There's millions of videos. You could probably also find them for the girl-boy paradox about how, you know, 14 out of 27 and 66.7 because of, you know, the different points of view you're looking at the problem from and the different information you have. But the next one is kind of a more general case of it. So we're just going to go to a quick break from our sponsors. And when I come back, we'll continue with some more paradoxes. I know it's less trivia today and more just me kind of explaining a bunch of complicated paradoxes that I know I'm not doing the greatest job in the world of, but I think it's interesting nonetheless to learn a little bit about them. And if you're intrigued about math and science, take a look at them. So stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM, and I'll be back with you in a minute.
CILU is sponsored in part by the students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
The Foundry at 242 Red River Road, open 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. Monday to Saturday, featuring folk and Mondays, karaoke Tuesdays, trivia Wednesdays, open stage Thursdays, and live music weekends. Find out more at thefoundrypub.com. The Thunder Bay Symphony Orchestra. Log on to tbso.ca or call 626-TBSO for details on the 2019-2020 season and how to get tickets. The Lakehead University Student Union, promoting action, advocacy, and service by bringing you student centers. Learn more by visiting their office in the tunnels of the student center or by logging on to lusu.ca.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Now, before the break, we were talking about paradoxes, and I was talking about the boy-girl paradox. And I don't think I did a great job of it, but either way, it's a little bit interesting. I'm going to talk about a more basic version right now. So it's not exactly the same, but it's kind of the same. So what this one is it's called the Monty Hall problem. Most people have heard of it. Now its name is similar to that of Let's Make a Deal's television game show hosted by Monty Hall. That's where it comes from. And it goes as below, as I state. Assume that a room is equipped with three doors. Behind two of the doors is a goat, and behind one of them is a shiny new car. You're asked to pick a door, and you will win whatever is behind the door. So let's say you pick door one. Before the doors open, however, someone who knows what's behind the doors, Monty Hall, opens one of the other two doors, revealing the goat, and asks you if you want to change your selection to the third door, i.e. the door which neither you picked nor he opened. Now, the problem is deciding whether you do want to switch. What is the correct answer, and what is the probability of that correct answer happening? I'm sure this stumped a few people. The correct answer is you do want to switch your door. If you don't switch your door, you have a 1/3 chance of winning. If you do switch your door, you have 2/3 of a chance of winning. So switching the door actually improves your chances of winning. Now, I hear some of you out there saying, well, Joshua, how does that make any sense? Because if I picked a door and then I'm shown what's behind one of the other doors, it's a 50-50 shot. Well, actually, it's not. Because no matter what, if you pick the correct door or not, you will be shown a door with a goat. And after he eliminates one of the doors for you, you don't improve your chances of winning to better than a third by sticking with your original choice. So if you switch your doors now, you have 2/3 of a chance. Now, the reason is because if you think about it, you don't have any more information about the doors. And from the start, your door had a 1/3% chance. Well, now you know what's behind one of the other doors. So that makes that door and the other door have 2/3 of a chance because you know what's behind the other one, making you have a 1/3 chance. And then you don't know what's behind the other one, but it'll improve your chances to 1 in 3. It's a little bit of a weird problem. And it's kind of complicated even for me sometimes to look at it. The statistics are a little interesting. So the thing is the specific clause of knowing where the car is and choosing the door without the car is where the odds of switching comes from. So you still have 3 chances. And why does it work? It's Monty opening the door doesn't change the odds. And that's what I was saying. Say, for example, there was 300 doors and you guess door 1, gives you a 1 in 300 chance of winning. Monty opens 298 of the remaining doors, leaving you to choose between door 1 or door 201. With your original odds, 1 in 300 remain the same for that randomly chosen door. Monty has given you an increased odds by giving you the best door out of 298 randomly chosen doors. So believe it or not, the last door, the door that is not opened, is the best one to switch. Because you have not improved the chances of your door being the correct door, but by opening and showing that behind the other one there is nothing behind it, it actually improves the chances that the other door is the correct one. Because your door still has a 1 in 3 chance, but the other one has now increased to 2 in 3 because you know what's behind the other door. Now, it's really difficult for people to wrap their head around this, and it's kind of a complicated one. So again, I suggest if you really want to learn, look it up on YouTube or do a little bit of research yourself. But it is a very, very weird problem. And when the probabilities are done, it does actually create the whole Monty Hall problem of 1/3 versus 1/2. Now, it's less of a... These last two paradoxes have been less of paradoxes and, well, at least the Monty Hall one is less of a paradox and more of an interesting figment of statistics. Now, the next one I'm about to do is another one that's weird. So the next one is one that I'm sure everyone's heard of before, and that's Schrodinger's cat. Now, this is an interesting paradox. And it was created by Erwin Schrödinger in the early to mid-1900s, after he created his Schrödinger equation, which won him a Nobel Prize. So, in 1935, he kind of proposed this experiment. So, what it is we've all heard of quantum mechanics. And whether we understand it or not, we've all know how you don't know where or how the particle is. You can know one out of two things about the particle at one time, and otherwise you know nothing about the particle because it has not decided. It's if you have a particle and you do not observe it, it is in multiple states at one time. You do not know what state it's in. Is it... And by states, I mean where you will find it, because when it collapses into a state, it becomes, it's a probability distribution, and that probability is what creates it. Now, what is Schrodinger's cat, and how does it kind of help explain this whole dilemma of what state is the particle in? Well, what happens and what it turns out goes on is, the probability of that particle being anywhere is, well, it's a probability, but the particle is actually in every state at one time. You do not know. It is in every state at the same moment, and you do not know what state it's in until observed. But then it'll collapse. Because once you observe it, it picks one of the probabilities and collapses into that state. So during the time of before the observing, the particle could be in six different places at the same moment. And that's where Schrodinger's cat comes in. It's kind of to help explain how this works. Now, the experiment goes like this. Now, it wasn't actually conducted. It was just, as Einstein said it, thought experiment. And what it is cat is placed in a steel box with a Geiger counter, a vial of poison, and a hammer, and a radioactive substance. When the radioactive substance decays, the Geiger counter detects it and triggers the hammer to release the poison, which subsequently kills the cat. The radioactive decay is a random process, and there's no way to predict when it will happen. Physicists say the atom exists in a state known as superposition, both decayed and not decayed at the same time. Until the box is open, an observer doesn't know whether the cat is alive or dead, because the cat's fate is intrinsically tied to whether or not the atom is decayed, and the cat would, as Schrodinger put it, be living and dead in equal parts until it is observed. So in other words, until the box is open, the cat's state is completely unknown, and therefore the cat is considered both alive and dead and at the same time until it is observed. Now, this is the same for quantum mechanics, and it's a little weird to think about. Now, some people might say, oh, well, it is in one of its states, it's just we can't observe that state. And that was one of the ideas of classical physics. However, through many different experiments in physics, they've actually found that Schrodinger's cat, a particle is in every state at once. And that is why, for example, you have the orbitals in chemistry that look really weird. And technically, until you observe where that electron is, it's every place in that cloud at the same time, because the probability says it will be somewhere, it is the most likely to be inside that cloud when you observe it. But you do not know where until it is observed. And this is one of the most famous paradoxes that many people hear of. And whether you want to consider it a paradox or not, I thought this is a great one to include, because everyone has heard about quantum mechanics and everyone thinks they've, kind of understand it, but it's a weird thing to think of, that a cat can be both alive and dead at the same time. You don't know for sure. And there's different variations of this problem, but in any case, the result is all the same. The cat is both alive and dead at the same time. Now, the next one is the dichotomy paradox. This is another one of, I believe, Zeno's paradoxes. Now, this is semi-similar to what we were talking about before with the Achilles and the tortoise. Imagine you set off walking down a street, and to reach the other end, you first have to reach halfway there. And to walk halfway there, you'd first have to reach a quarter of the way there. And to walk a quarter of the way there, you'd first have to walk an eighth of the way there. And before that, a 16th of the way there, and a 32nd of the way there, a 64th, a 128th, and so on. Ultimately, in order to perform even the simplest of tasks, like walking down a street, you'd have to perform an infinite number of smaller tasks. Something that, by definition, is utterly impossible. Not only that, but no matter how small the first part of the journey is said to be, it can always be halved to create another task. The only way in which it cannot be halved would be to consider the first part of the journey to be of absolutely no distance whatsoever. And in order to complete the task of moving no distance whatsoever, you can't even start your journey in the first place. So this runs off the fact that you'd have to go, it would take you an infinite amount of time to walk the distance to the other side of the street. But if you didn't move at all, you can't even start your journey. So how do you apparently get anywhere? And this is the dichotomy paradox. And it's another one of Zeno's weird paradoxes that's weird to think about. This paradox is kind of an interesting one. And again, it deals with the idea of infinity. Now, again, it's a little bit weird. And the answer is probably going to be a little bit difficult to understand. Now, there's certain answers that people say that give us an idea. Like, for example, on Aristotle's Physics tells us Diogenes the Cynic did, by silently standing and walking, point out that there is a matter of the most common experience. Things do move, and we do very well know that, you know, Atlanta would have no trouble reaching her bus stop. But this would not impress Zeno, who, as paid up Parmenidean, held that many things are not as they appear. It may appear that Diogenes is walking or that Atlanta is running, but appearances can be deceptive, and surely we have a logical proof that they are in fact not moving at all. It's really weird to think about. Now, another response which can be given by Aristotle is to point out that if we divide the distances run, we should also divide the total time taken. There's half the time for the final one half, a quarter of the time for the previous quarter, eighth for the eighth, and so on. Thus, each fractional difference has just the right fraction of finite total time for Atlanta to complete it. And thus, the distance can be completed in a finite time. Aristotle felt this reply should satisfy Zeno. However, he also realized that it could not be the end of the matter. So, this is where it kind of gets interesting. Now, of course, one could again claim that some infinite sums do have finite totals, and in particular that the sums of the pieces is 1 times the total time, which is, of course, a complete solution would demand a rigorous account of infinite summation like Cauchy's. However, Aristotle did not make such a move. Instead, he drew a sharp distinction between what he termed a continuous line and a line divided in parts. Consider a simple division of a line in two. On one hand, there is the undivided line. On the other, the line with the midpoint selected as the boundary of the two halves. Aristotle claimed that there are two distinct things, and that the latter is only a potentially derivable form of the former. Next, you take the common sense view that time is like a geometrical line. It considers the time it takes to complete the run. We can again distinguish the two cases. There's a continuous interval from start to finish, and there's the interval divided into Zeno's infinity of half runs. And this is kind of where you get it. But it's still a very weird paradox, and it's still not a full explanation. Now, there is also other things, like the idea that, like I said before, infinite sums can exist as a finite number. The answer is finite. And this is where another paradox, one of my favorite paradoxes I can actually find, arises. Now again, that one was just about definitions, which again, as much as it sounds mathematical, can be very philosophical. Because logic is both philosophical and mathematical at the same time. Now, the next paradox we're going to look at is probably my favorite paradox of all time. But before we go into that paradox, we're going to listen to another paradoxical song. Now, it goes, "It rained all night the day I left, the weather it was dry. The sun so hot I froze to death." What song is that from? Turns out the song is "Oh Susanna," and that's a paradoxical statement. So here is "Oh Susanna" on CILU 102.7 FM. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Now we're going into the last little bit of our show. And the next thing we're going to cover is actually my favorite paradox out of all of them. Now, we'll go over a couple more after this. But I really want to cover this one because this one is my favorite paradox. And even for me, I don't know the full extent of it, but I know enough of it to explain it. It is called Gabriel's Horn. Now, this paradox is kind of a geometric one. What does it entail? It's also called Torricelli's bit. What it is it's a geometric figure with an infinite surface area but finite volume. So, its name refers to the Abrahamic tradition identifying the archangel Gabriel as an angel who blows a horn to announce judgment day, associated with divine, infinite, and finite. Now, the properties of this figure were first studied by Italian physicist and mathematician Evangelista Torricelli in the 17th century. Now, if any of you don't know what this is, I suggest you go look it up. But it's formed through taking the graph x is equal to 1 over x, or sorry, y is equal to 1 over x, and taking the domain x is greater than or equal to 1, and rotating it in three dimensions about the x-axis. Now, for those of you who don't know, after you do that, it will go from 1 to infinity, but it will go along the x-axis, but never quite reach 0. It'll get close to 0, but never quite reach it. Now, back then, it was used using Cavalieri's principle, because it was before the invention of calculus. But today, calculus can be used to calculate the volume and surface area of the horn between 1 and x equals a, where a is greater than 1. Using integration, it is possible to find the volume and the surface area. The thing is, is the value a can be as large as required, but it can be seen from the equation that the volume of the part of the horn between 1 and a will never exceed pi. Never. It is impossible to exceed, because when you take the volume, you get the equation pi times the integral of 1 to a of 1 over x squared dx, which will give you an equation of pi times 1 minus 1 over a. Now, if you subbed in 1 over infinity, it would be, well, 1 over infinity tends to 0, so it would be 1 minus 0, or 1 minus 0.9 infinitely long. Now, the thing is if you multiply that by pi, it will never go greater than pi, meaning it has a finite volume. However, the surface area, it diverges, and it is always greater than 2 pi. So the thing is the volume approaches pi as x approaches infinity, and that's the volume. But the surface area gives a lower bound for the areas as 2 pi times the natural log of a. There is no upper bound for a logarithm and as a approaches infinity. That means in the case that the horn has an infinite surface area. This is a really weird thing to think about. You'd be able to fill the horn with a volume of paint. However, you would never be able to paint the entire surface. Now, it's an interesting one. It's actually known also as the painter's paradox. Because again, you can fill it up, but you cannot cover it. It's really interesting. I mean, the paradox can also be looked at like this with the painter's paradox. Paint is only so small, so it will be able to cover it eventually because the end of it will never be able to be covered by paint because it'll get too small. But this is a really interesting paradox and actually one of my favorites that I've ever learned. And I suggest you look into it. It's a very interesting one. Now, that's pretty much all I've got. There might be one other I might quickly look at, which is also semi-similar to what we looked at before the paradox with the bootstrap paradox. That's what it was. Sorry, I just had a moment there where I forgot it. There's another really interesting paradox, which is also one of my favorite, which is similar to the bootstrap paradox. Now, this again is one of the weird cases of, well, what happens. So, you have a time machine. And actually, this is very similar to what happens. They kind of cover this in Back to the Future. It's which inconsistencies emerge through changing the past. It's a common description. A person travels into the past and kills their own grandfather before the conception of their father or mother, which prevents the time traveler's existence. Despite its title, the grandfather paradox does not exclusively regard the contradiction of killing one's own grandfather to prevent one's birth. Rather, the paradox regards any action that alters the past, and since there is a contradiction whenever the past becomes different from the way it was. So, basically, what it is you go back and change time. But the thing is if you go back and change the time, kill your grandfather, you're never born. But if you're never born, how can you go back into the past to kill your grandfather? And it's a very common sci-fi time traveling dilemma. So it's led to some really interesting paradoxes and seems logically impossible. Now, again, this goes back to the idea of causal loops. So, it can exist. However, what would happen is it would create a causal loop. Because the system can be self-consistent in a self-consistent way, which avoids the grandfather paradox, but again, creates a causal loop. So this is very similar in concepts to a causal loop. And it creates a very interesting, you know, a time loop, a causal loop. And it follows the same paradox. So if you're interested, there's lots of good examples online. Some of these are even hard for me to explain because some of them are very complicated. And they can create some really, really weird paradoxes and things. But again, if you're really interested in it, I suggest looking up on YouTube each of the paradoxes I mentioned, or looking online at paradoxes. They're a very interesting thing, figment of mathematics and science. I want to thank you all for listening this morning. I hope everyone's has a good day. Still looks like it's snowing a little bit out there. Snow's still coming down. So again, be careful when you go to the house today, and just be careful in general. I hope everyone has a good week, and I'll see you all next week. Don't know what the theme is next week, but hoping it's good. So see you all next week. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. I'm signing off for the week.
The thought of a world without independent quality nonprofit radio could be quite scary. Scarier than werewolves or vampires. Well, from Friday, March 6th till Saturday, March 14th, CILU 102.7 FM is going to be fun driving the stake of campus and community radio straight through your heart. Check out some special one-of-a-kind programming from your favorite peeps. Win some prizes, call our pledge line to donate, talk to a real-life human being, or do it online at luradio.ca. Donate there. So keep an eye out or an ear out for fun to drive. It's going from Friday, March 6th to Saturday, March 14th. Fun to drive.
CILU is supported in part by the students of Lakehead University, our sponsors, and our listeners. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Copperfin Credit Union, Northwestern Ontario's largest locally owned credit union. Experience the convenience of their mobile banking app and online financial solutions anywhere, anytime. Copperfin Credit Union, life forward. Sarah Curtin, your neighborhood realtor. She's on top of what's happening in Thunder Bay's market, and she'll help you buy or sell your home. Call or text her anytime at 632-3635 or find her online at sarahcurtin.com. The Walleye, the definitive source for information on music, food, art, and entertainment in Thunder Bay. This month's issue is on stands for free now. Find it around town or online and interactive at thewalleye.ca.
CILU now presents Indie Beat.
Thanks for joining me for Indie Beat. I'm Mae Wandinger. Graham Dick is a pop and jazz singer-songwriter from Delisle, who has performed on the main stage at Saskatchewan Jazz Festival, as well as at Saskatoon's Telemiracle. I'll be featuring Graham Dick in half an hour. First, here's Aaron Nesrul with Daylight.